we took the last two shows to review an article on the LifeSite website that somebody sent me, which I thought was fascinating, having to do with the eight stages and rise and falls of civilization. I'd like to follow up those shows with perhaps a couple of shows unpacking Archbishop Charles Chaput's address at the Napa Institute Conference. Now, Mary Lou and I are great fans of Archbishop Chaput, who is now the Archbishop of Philadelphia, was in Denver for many years, who definitely is quite a stand-up guy. And he has a way with words, and he does not mince words. And we are great fans of the way that he expresses things, because we're pretty much on his same page, aren't we, Mary Lou?
We are, indeed. And I would recommend two of his books, one being Render Under Caesar, which is about serving the nation by living our Catholic beliefs in political life, which would tie into what the article that we just covered. And additionally, the one that he references in what we're going to talk about today, which is his latest book, Strangers in a Strange Land, and it's Living the Catholic Faith in a Post-Christian World. So he provides that plan and roadmap for us. So I highly recommend both of these books to everyone.
And this is an address that he gave this summer. I think it was sometime in July.
Yes, in July.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At the Napa Institute.
At the Napa Institute, which is also quite a worthy. I mean, it's a, for about a week, people get together and they hear these amazing lectures. And I'm always envious. I always want to go too.
But I would really like to go to it. I don't know whether we can, whether it's just bishops and everything. I know Spitzer is in
right now. Right. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so this is how he starts this. This is just kind of an article. It's actually, I think it's the script of the
talk. The talk. Mm-hmm.
Which I thought was pretty cool. This is how he starts. And it has to do again with Catholics, America, and a World Made New. What the heck is going on? We tried to maybe perhaps offer some ideas for during our last article. I mean, obviously, you know what we think, but let's see what you think. A third of American men, not women, will sooner or later have an anxiety disorder, and so will 40% of all women. More than 70% of American young people are now physically or mentally unfit for military service. How did that happen? At least a third of college seniors, even at our best schools and after years of elite education, cannot make a coherent argument. And what gets me is they can't make the argument, nor can they spell the argument. They can't write, and they can't talk. And it's just, it's very discouraging. And 16% of women in the Navy deployed to shipboard service come back to shore pregnant. I like how
no
it says,
surprise.
This last item may not need a lot of explaining. Right? Human nature. All these facts are true. He gives the sources as the Wall Street Journal and the Associated Press. But what is his point? He said, and I like how he quotes a famous Prime Minister of England under Queen Victoria, Benjamin Disraeli. He famously said there are three kinds of lies: lies, damned lies, and statistics, which is interesting, which is true. You know, every special interest group has a raft of statistics that they can quote, but a lot of they don't tell you, for instance, when Planned Parenthood quotes from the Guttmacher Institute, what they don't tell you is that the Guttmacher Institute is a branch of Planned Parenthood, and they are far from being the neutral pollsters and surveyors and statisticians that they would like you to believe, right? So
exactly,
a lot of things are just biased, right?
So what he's saying in here is information can be true without telling the truth, which is the example you just gave.
Mm-hmm. Knowledge is not wisdom. Wisdom, not knowledge, is the framework of a fully human life. So that's true. Information. It's about information, not formation. It's about formation, not information. Yes,
exactly.
Information is power. Knowledge is power. But in the end, wisdom, what to do with the knowledge that you have. Because we know, I know anyway, lots of people with very high IQs and with a lot of facts to their fingertips and very sort of they know a lot of stuff, but they don't have any common sense. You look at their lives and they're wrecks. So they might be, you know, at the apex of their
financial
particular pyramid, but what's the point of knowing all this stuff if you don't have the wisdom to use it? Wisdom is the architecture of interior peace. I thought that was beautifully done.
Yes.
Scripture is the word of God, and Ecclesiastes tells us the words of the wise in a quiet are better than the shouting of a ruler among fools. Wisdom is more powerful than might and better than the weapons of war. And now he's quoting scripture, obviously. He quoted Ecclesiastes and then Proverbs as well. Wisdom is more precious than jewels, and once we have it, then knowledge becomes pleasant to the soul. Meaning what? Once we have the wisdom, which is one of the gifts of the Holy Spirit, then we will know what to do with the knowledge that we obtain. Because if not, it just remains a bunch of facts. And just because we can do something doesn't mean that we should do something. Especially in the area of bioethics. So then he says, basically what he says is a new world is not necessarily a good one. Or even a little bit better one. The good news is that we make the world. Augustine said, it's no use whining about the times because we are the times. And isn't that true? You and I know plenty of people who just complain about how it's never going to get any worse than this. And how could this all happen? And what's going on? And it's never been this bad. Well, you know, every generation has thought it's never been this bad.
Well, when you're asking what is the problem, we are the problem.
That's right. That was G.K. Chesterton.
That's right.
Right. So our choices matter, our actions matter. So a lot of people, I think, are so used to being disconnected from others and alienated in our online world, in our social media world, which is electronic and not really face-to-face, where people are sort of being lulled into thinking that, no, I just live in my apartment and I go to work and I might see my friends on the weekend, but I don't matter. And my choices don't matter and my life doesn't matter. Well, you know, as Christians, we know that every life matters and that every choice matters because we're a body. And so what you decide to do is going to affect me, even if you think it's a private choice. Because in the end, there is no private choice.
There is not. I mean, he reminds us that it's through us that God acts in society and the gospel of Jesus Christ is carried forward.
That's right.
How often do you talk about this day in and day out?
And we need to own the mission. The mission isn't just for people who are on TV or people who are bishops. The mission is for everyone. Everyone has a mission. And our mission in the beginning of the third millennium is the new evangelization. It's re-evangelizing first and foremostly those people who are in the pews and think they know everything, when unfortunately they don't. And they think that by just checking their little Catholic boxes that somehow everything's going to be okay, when instead it's so much more than that.
What happens at the end of every Mass? We're sent out. What are we sent out to do? To do our mission in God's name. To spread the word. We've got our marching orders, and nothing's going to change for the better until we start doing that.
Archbishop Chaput quotes Pope Francis's Evangelii Gaudium, the joy of the gospel. And the Pope reminds us how easy it is to believe in Jesus' victory, to lift up our hearts, because it's easy to get kind of hopeless. You know, I think I know a lot of Catholics who are hopeless. They're helpless. They're hopeless, meaning what? They're not hopeless, but they have no hope. They have somehow learned not to hope in the Lord. They think that somehow everything is going to happen and other people are going to do all this great stuff and they're going to obtain all these great things, but somehow it's not going to happen to them. And if their loved ones fall sick, they will not recover. And God doesn't want to heal them. And God doesn't want to listen to that. I mean, they're really living in these little boxes where they don't really believe the things that they profess. Or they might tend to want to believe the things that they profess, but they've been so evangelized by the culture and the world of materialism that they think the Lord possibly could never intervene in their lives. But in fact, he does.
And you know, in the Joy of the Gospel, Pope Francis also says, nobody goes off to battle unless he's fully convinced of victory beforehand. Mm-hmm. If we don't believe if we're going to go out on this mission that we're not going to win, what's the point?
That's right. And the number one thing is don't let the world crush the joy that is our birthright through baptism. Joy that is detached from circumstances. So it's the peace that surpasses and transcends understanding. So he basically then goes on to 11 simple observations in which he kind of boils down his book, Strangers in a Strange Land. First, people and nations change all the time. Change is natural and it's healthy as long as it grows organically out of the past and at a pace that people can digest and observe, which is interesting because our growth at this point has become so vertiginous that it's hard to keep track with what happened yesterday, let alone what happened 10 years ago, right?
I am constantly trying to, quote unquote, keep up with the technology, mm-hmm. which is always a challenge, but it's, you know, it's so fast paced now. The world changes on a dime, the technology.
And the thing I keep trying to explain to people who are my age or older, who say, oh, I can't do this, or I don't want to do this, or I don't, you know, that a lot of the technology seems a little bit beyond them and they don't want to even try and make an effort. The way I say it is, look, you know, maybe you normally as a person wouldn't want to do this, and that's fine. You have the freedom to do that. But if you're going to be an effective evangelizer, if you're going to reach everybody, not just people like you or people your age or older, then you need to get with a program and you need to insofar as God gives you the understanding and the capabilities, you need to make yourself all things to all people, regardless of how old you are or regardless of where you live. Or you know what I'm saying? I think St. Paul would have been on Twitter, on social media, he'd be sending out email blasts. I mean, seriously, I think true evangelizers are those who take advantage of whatever the age offers them to reach the people. Does that make sense?
Yeah, we need to be engaged and use the tools that are accessible to us to do it in the best way.
Because they're only tools in the end.
Exactly.
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 Second, the nature and pace of changes in our culture today have no precedent. They're extraordinarily fast and they're also accelerating. Just think about the rate of change between the year 1000 and the year 1200, for instance, in Europe. Not much
changed.
How about from the year 1200 to the year 1400 at the very beginning of the Renaissance in Southern Europe? Not much. Artistic, beautiful artistic development, yes, but maybe architectural development, but the kinds of sea changes that we have seen in the past 40 years or 30 years. Think about somebody living in England in 1898 who, was familiar with the steam engine and maybe cars were just starting to come out, you know, who knows. But basically their life had been unchanged since the 1700s, the 1600s. And then think about that same person transported only 100 years into the future in 1998 and the level of change, both societal and technological. So we tend to think about technology, but it's everything.
Well, you know, today robots are taking the place of humans in doing so many jobs. And I walked into McDonald's the other day, and I never go to McDonald's, but we wanted coffee as we were traveling back from Florida. And you go to a board now and order. You don't go to the counter and order.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't seen that before. It was extraordinary to think that has changed. So instead of having that action with a human being, we are now going to go to a computer screen and order our food. And these are, it's just an example of the changes we're seeing day in and day out in this.
But soon you'll be able to do like the Starbucks app allows you to do. You order on your app and then you click the nearest store and then you go in and your order's ready. I mean, you know, that's what's coming to everything. It's not just for Starbucks. I think it's happening everywhere.
Oh, absolutely.
I have a problem with that. I mean, you know, if it makes it easier, why not? You know, I may have a problem with it if it cuts out people from making a living. But I don't know. I think that that automation offers new challenges, but I think it offers new possibilities and new opportunities. Right? So number three, because of this very accelerated pace of change, which has no precedent, because as I was trying to say earlier, think about the level of change that has happened in our lifetimes. In our lifetimes, when I was growing up in Italy, to call the United States, you had to call up the Italian operator and make an appointment to have them call you back the next day at a certain time to try and reach your party in the United States. I remember that. I remember silly things like garter belts instead of pantyhoses. You know, still 12,
absolutely.
13, that happened. I mean, that's just silly examples. But think about having to stay home all day because you're waiting for a phone call, which happened up until 20 years ago.
Well, when we traveled, we didn't have phones. We would go to pay phones if we were traveling to make a phone call here. And I remember in Switzerland going to the post office, and you would go to these cabins. They would make the call for you back to the U.S., and then they would say, go to cabin one or cabin two, and you would go in this little room in order to talk. I mean, it's just amazing.
In the past 20, 30, 40 years.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. The level of communication. I was this morning, somebody sent me a message on Facebook that some guy on his phone in Vietnam, at a Marian shrine in Vietnam, recorded from a distance a statue of the Virgin Mary that supposedly moved. Now, I don't know if that's a hoax. I don't know. Her cloak was fluttering in the breeze. It was from a distance. I couldn't tell. I mean, I saw some movement, but, you know, it could be, who knows what it is, right? But the fact that I could see this morning from Lexington, Kentucky, somebody's cell phone video from Vietnam about an apparition of the Virgin Mary, it kind of melts it all together, right?
It does. It does.
You know, and self-driving cars and smart roads that won't let you run off the road and washing machines that will tumble your clothes for hours so that when you're ready to pick your clothes out of the dryer, they'll be fresh, you know, that kind of stuff. You know, I'm sure there's so much more, the splitting of the atom. How about the particle accelerator in France?
Right.
You know, I mean, there's all kind. I mean, we're going from the ridiculous to the sublime, obviously, in terms of change. But it's such a big change that the third item of Cardinal Chaput is this may lead to a sense of discontinuity and confusion.
Confusion.
The last 60 years has been a series of disruptions in what the words America and being an American mean, which is interesting. You know, the meaning has been co-opted first by one party and then another and then back to the other party. Right.
Correct.
There are lots of reasons for this confusion, but among the most important are changes, not just changes, but transformations in our legal philosophy. It's now okay to let the Supreme Court decide even matters of legislation. Our sexual mores, well, don't have to say much about that, the sexual revolution. Our demography, nobody's having children, or less people are having children, or only one child and are not replacing themselves. Educational philosophy, value-neutral education, that kind of silliness. Economy and technology.
Technology.
Fifth, we cannot go back to the good old days, which I thought was interesting. You even have Catholics who want to go back to Christendom, you know, to the Middle Ages. That's not happening. Plus, I don't think it's particularly healthy to want that to happen, right? People who walk around saying the Latin Mass is the only Mass. Well, the Latin Mass was only around for a certain number of centuries. Jesus did not give the Latin Mass in Latin. If anything, he gave it in Aramaic. So if we want to be true purists, we should be going back to Aramaic. I mean, you know what I'm saying? There's no way to go back to the good old days. Also, because really the good old days really probably weren't that good for the people who were in them at the time. You know, we idealize what happened in the past. But who knows what those people who were actually living it thought.
But it gives us a valid excuse not to be thrown into the future like we are.
I know, right?
And he's saying you can't do that.
Nostalgia is always misleading. The good old days had plenty of their own problems.
Right.
And partly because the gulf between American culture in 1957 and 2017 is too wide and too deep to bridge, which is what we were talking about. The world and the country are now drastically different places from the image we older citizens have in our memories. America is a much less biblically influenced nation than it was at its founding. And our moral vision of who we are and what our lives mean is much more fragmented. Which politician today do you think would repeat the words of John Adams and General Washington when they said that America is a nation of laws, but only moral citizens will be able to live in this new democracy because only moral people can be trusted to keep the law without the law standing over them like a tutor or like a, you know, like a master with a stick, you know, sanctions and penalties and taxes and that kind of stuff. You wouldn't hear somebody today saying that only a true moral and religious individual will be able to be the person who is governed in this new nation.
Well, and sadly, you know, morality is not even listed as being essential in that anymore. So there's been quite a bit of changes, and we've seen that in tons of legislation, as you've covered over time in many, many, many programs, of the sexual morals, the abortion, everything else that's come to fragment the family and how we are to live as moral human beings.
Well, that's the item 6 in his little list. 6, the birth control and the separation of sex from procreation have altered the fundamental meaning of sex. It's worth noting that same-sex activism now runs on a moral passion for gay rights and social acceptance. It's not just acceptance, but approval. So we've moved from tolerance to approval to I not only approve, I accept all your sexual expression, and I have to endorse it personally, or I won't be able to keep my job.
Exactly.
Or I'm fired, or I won't be able to obtain my education, etc. From a biblical point of view, that passion is deeply flawed. Arguments for religious liberty and erotic liberty stem from two very different ideas of who the person is and what our sexuality means. But a moral passion, even when it's wrong, is always powerful. Thus, concessions to the nominal gay equality are no longer enough. It's why a leader and financier of the gay rights movements like Tom Gill, I thought that was horrifying, by the way, now insists that he wants to punish the wicked. But who are the wicked?
You and me.
That's, you know, when I woke up this morning, I didn't really think, you know, I'm flawed and I'm sinful. But just because we adhere to the Judeo-Christian ethic, that makes us wicked in the eyes of this particular segment of the American population. And that's pretty daunting. 7th point. Democracy advances equality by flattening out injustices and social inequities. But it goes much further than that. It also tends to flatten out distinctions. So yeah, no authority, no distinctions, no hierarchies. Unguided by religious faith, democracy flattens out even the human spirit, because any kind of divine transcendence or human excellence also implies a kind of inequality. And we've seen that in the schools. Everybody on the team gets a prize, even the one who didn't even, like, never got off the bench, you know, for the season. Why? Because if not, it would be unequal. You know, everybody gets the same grade, or everybody is graded on a certain in a certain way, because we don't want anybody to feel bad that somehow there's an inequality between somebody who studied and got an A and somebody who didn't study and got a C+. Right. So right. There is that. I mean, I see it, you know, from a school point of view, but it's probably much more than that. De Tocqueville said, democracy creates not a just and new different kind of political order, but also a new and different kind of humanity. Yeah, we have to know where to flatten that things out and where not to. And the whole moral conscience of the person is not the area to be flattening out. 8th point, democracy exists to ensure the freedom of the individual. Fair enough. But in doing so, democracy can easily become hostile to any individual, to any obligations that the individual himself doesn't freely create or choose. So therefore, democracy can automatically be hostile to religion.
Because, which we're seeing in today's world.
Because democracy didn't create those religious obligations. It's just trying to safeguard them. But the minute they perceive those religious obligations as a threat, then out comes the steamroller, right?
Right.
As Christians, we don't invent our own stories. We're part of a much larger sacred story that links us across time and continents to everyone. and that creates a political problem. Families, communities, churches, all these things place pre-existing duties on the individual, duties that limit and channel his liberty. Therefore, they're suspect and can end up being attacked. You know, Benedict XVI famously said, God is being perceived as the enemy of human freedom. Somehow, any kind of religious duty or moral requirement is seen as a restriction on liberty. But really, it's not. It allows us to be truly free. But in our society, that is being seen as limitation of autonomy, evil. We need to have the freedom or the license to do anything we want to do. It's the imperial self. Me, myself, and I, that's the unholy trinity. I get to do anything that I feel is right. So you have the primacy of emotion, the primacy of sentimentalism, the primacy of not hurting people's feelings. But in fact, if you are truly a Christian and you adhere to the law of God, then there are going to be certain things that are non-negotiable. Therefore, they're suspected and can be end up being attacked. Point nine, technology, for all its advantages, also carries with it some serious problems. I guess we know that, right? We use it, for instance, in the area of reproduction. You know, where do you stop with the embryos being created? How do you dispose of embryos that have been frozen and just left there to languish in limbo? How do you counteract the argument that we need to clone human beings just for parts, for spare parts? You know, if you have no transcendent or moral governor, all this stuff is allowable. You know, the distinction between licit and illicit no longer subsists.
Exactly.
We use our tools, but our tools also use us. They shape the way we think, the way we act, and the way we see the world. Technological man sees the world not as a gift from God to be treasured, but as a collection of dead material to be organized and used. And that utilitarianism usually spreads the way we treat the environment, other living people, other people, etc. So, translate it into the euthanasia movement. Death with dignity is code for I get to knock grandma in the head the minute she's not useful, or the minute that she's experiencing pain, or the minute that she is in a coma, or the minute, you know what I'm saying? Because she's not useful anymore. And if anything, she's draining resources from people who could use them better.
And we see that happening. There are boards at certain hospitals out west, I think Washington or someplace, where they are making these decisions. And for the individual.
And that flies in the face of the religious attitude of the Judeo-Christian ethic, which is that there are no expendable individuals. There are no expendable people.
Well, that goes against thou shalt not kill. Mm-hmm. And, you know, going back to that basic, that's how things have been so twisted and turned. And I always say, as St. John Paul II said, you know, when you start using language and changing its meaning and calling one thing something else, it creates all this confusion. That's what we're seeing.
Mm-hmm. So as a result, there's a big stress in the corporate and medical worlds right now to push ahead, no matter what. So AI, artificial intelligence. I'm sure you've seen all the movies I've seen, scary movies, probably unrealistic, but still they investigate some pretty useful, interesting topics. Gene splicing, cloning, as we were talking about before, the whole bioethics field is turning into a nightmare. And I love this example. Facebook is exploring, and this isn't a joke, how to message your friends and update your newsfeed telepathically.
I can't even imagine that.
Remember, Scientific American last year had an article about how people are saying that in 5 years, there will be neural nets, very fine netting, that we will be able to superimpose in our brains that will dispense with the need for any hardware. We become the hardware. So we can go online, we can call our friends, we can do our work. Without a phone, without a laptop, through a neural net. Now, that sounds like science fiction, but Scientific American says it's within 5 years.
I can't even imagine.
Maybe that's what they think about updating Facebook telepathically. I don't know. And China now has a national campaign to record and track all of its citizens with facial recognition technology, just like in the movies, science fiction, the better to understand and influence their behavior.
And influence their behavior is the key word there. That's scary.
Mm-hmm. When our headlines claim, quote, smart machines will free us all, unquote, and, quote, the gene editors are only getting started, unquote, it's time to pay attention. The Wall Street Journal published both these stories just in the last few months. So, you know, meanwhile, where most of us are watching reality television and worried about getting the latest iPhone 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 or whatever, this is what's going on in the culture. So our time has escaped us for today. I hope you will join us next time as we continue to explore this great article by Archbishop Cardinal Charshaw. Thanks for joining us.